Our first case this morning is in the parental rights as to E.W. It's case number 63767. Mr. Wall, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Seda and Associate Justices Ms. Nicole Loudwig and I, on behalf of our clients, thank you for the opportunity of being here today and addressing this important case. I will take some of the time and try to reserve approximately half of the time for her to address the specific issues as to her client.
And just by way of reminder, the time clock in front of you is the full time. So just remember that when you're looking to split your
time. I understand that, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, Justices, we are not here to suggest that anybody in this case has acted in a manner which would be inappropriate. We understand that everybody has the highest and best of motives in attempting to protect what were considered or were perceived to be the interests of EW, who is the most important player in this action today. Nevertheless, I represent Jennifer, a heartbroken mother. EW is 4 years, 5 months old. He has been out of his mother's custody for 4 years, 4 months of that time. Not because of anything that she did, not because she wasn't a fit mother, not because she wasn't trying to be a loving mother, not because of any other matter except the fact that she needed some help, that she suffers from some cognitive difficulties. She was doing the very best that she can. And when I look at the record in this case and I read it as a whole, it looks like there was this big, long trial, but there was actually a short trial over a period of days. And almost all of the evidence in the record that was presented was evidence to show that Jennifer had failed in her prior relationship with her prior daughter, who at that time was a teenager, and two other children who had been not in her care or custody, but living in her home and somewhat under her care. The county focused all of its attention on those alleged prior failures, and through testimony which was almost all hearsay. It came in under the exception to hearsay that it's not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And yet all of that testimony was used for only one purpose, the truth of the matter that was asserted, which was that Jennifer has proven in the past that she's not capable of being a mother, and so the county precipitously...
Were there objections made in the district court to the hearsay testimony?
There were objections in the district court to the hearsay, repeated objections to the hearsay.
And the district court said, I'm admitting it, not for the truth, but for whatever
reason. The district court said specifically that it was being offered for the purpose of addressing the issue of why the county actors acted in the way that they did, not for the proof of the matter asserted, which was that Jennifer had failed previously. And yet, if you read the decision, it was only used for the purpose of demonstrating that Jennifer had failed previously in those previous relationships.
Mr. Wall, don't we also have a situation in this case where, as is typical in a 432B case, a case plan was presented to mom and to dad in this instance. They proceeded through, or at least it appears the record would suggest that mom and dad made efforts to complete that case plan. And the finding of the judge was that they, aside from the hearsay issue, that they failed to complete the case plan successfully. Because that concerns me. And the state's going to hear the same question. This is a true dilemma to me, and I want to just cut to the chase. Because we've got a standard in the court that you're appealing from, the decision that you're appealing from, that says that we look at parental fault and parental fitness, but then we always balance it against best interest of the kid. Now, we've got a case plan here. Your client, according to the record, did the best she could, but according to state standards or county standards in this case, it wasn't enough they felt comfortable the kid would be protected. Fair enough? Fair statement so far what I'm saying?
The social workers didn't think she had enough change in her personality in order to be, that they could feel that she was had made enough progress in their opinion, even though she did every single thing that was asked of her. She complied in every way that she possibly could. She had her child ripped away from her, 28 days old, and only got to visit him then months later, and then only an hour a day, once a week. She got to come in, and in a fishbowl, they gave her no help of any kind.
The state's not obligated to provide help, as you describe it. The case law is very clear. Lack of resources is not enough to overcome the presumption below. So my question here is, you know, we had a 28-day-old child who indeed was taken at a very young age, but taken for a pretty good reason. Failure to thrive is on the edge of starvation. So what do we do here? This is a true dilemma to me.
It is a true dilemma. The failure to thrive issue is the first issue, and then we've got the two presumptions. The child had gained weight, was a normal weight the first week. Nurse Palmy didn't even come for 2 weeks, and then she was only there three times in a two-week period. The first time she was there, the child was at normal weight. The second child time there, the child had gained 8 ounces, which was normal, and she praised her for feeding her, and the third time was a problem. There could have been, the state isn't simply in the business of taking children from their parents. The proper method for handling this would have been if there was a danger at that point, and it's not really clear from this record that there was, but if there was a danger, they could have taken that child from the home for a short period of time, made sure the child was stabilized. There was no evidence of some neurological problem. There was only Ms. Swin who said, I thought that if they didn't feed the child, there might be some problem in the future. There was no medical evidence of that. They simply took the child and did not make any kind of real effort to bring that child back home. They should have been bringing that child back home. There are two presumptions in the statute. Neither one of them was properly applied in this case. The first presumption is that, first, there has to be parental fault. And the parental fault is abandonment, neglect, unfitness. None of those apply. Risk of injury, token efforts. The district court specifically found that there were mammoth efforts, not a lack of token efforts. So the only one left is failure of parental adjustment. And there is, the first presumption is, if the child has been out of the home 14 months out of 20 months, it's not a presumption that you should terminate the rights. The presumption is that only token efforts have been made. That's the only presumption. And the district court specifically found that wasn't so in this case. There had been mammoth efforts. There were overwhelming efforts. There weren't token efforts. We have a mother who's doing everything she can within her capabilities to keep her child. The first presumption doesn't apply. The second presumption is failure of adjustment. And it's... That only applies if a parent fails to substantially comply with a case plan. That has to do with whether the parent is doing something purposely, refusing to comply, failure to substantially comply. It's not make a behavioral change that the parent may or may not even be capable of. And the end result here isn't we're going to keep this child and we're going to keep working with you over time because you're the child's parent. The end result here is we terminated the rights, all of them. No visitation, no nothing. It's been 2 years. She hasn't even been able to see him. He was taken out of that home for one reason and one reason only. The county was afraid because of past failures.
So now what do we do with the four-year lack of attachment, all of the issues that go along with the fact that, as you point out, the child has been away from mom since birth, essentially?
Bingo. That is the difficult issue. That's exactly the problem that we have. EW has been out of the custody of his parents for his entire life. He basically is a stranger to them. There are going to have to be mammoth efforts to first build a relationship between them and then to reinstate the parental rights to some degree. Some amount of involvement in the life. That's going to be a difficult thing that's going to have to be worked out by child services. But we don't have to come up with all of the details of that here. What we have to come up with here is the legal standard. And the legal standard is there are only two presumptions that apply. They were both misapplied in this case. The county simply failed in its burden in this case to demonstrate The brief keeps saying substantial evidence of clear and convincing evidence. There's no such thing. They had to have clear and convincing evidence. This record simply does not have any evidence. I'd like to give the rest of the time to Nicole.
And Mr. Walt, to be fair, because I took up a significant amount of your time, I'm going to give each side at least at this point another minute, so you will have an extra minute if you need be.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nicole Ludwig. I represent the appellant, Michael, who's the father in this case. I wanted to follow up on a couple of things that my co-counsel brought up. And the first thing here is the case plan that these parents were given. The initial case plan was not put in place for 3 months after the child was taken out of the home. That case plan was never modified, and it was never adjusted. It was never modified or adjusted specifically for these parents' special needs. Both parents have been deemed to have cognitive deficiencies, and yet the plan remained the same. The parents both did everything that was asked of them. They completed every case plan task, yet they were never able to achieve case plan objectives. So the question becomes, if the county is over here saying that every 6 months the plan is reevaluated, if they saw a consistent pattern where the parents were completing tasks but not completing objectives, why was the plan not modified in some way? This court has said that a parent cannot be deemed unsuitable by reason of failure to comply with requirements and plans that are unclear or have not been communicated to the parent or which are impossible for the parent to abide by. The parent must be shown to be at fault in some manner and cannot be judged unsuitable by reason of failure to comply with requirements and plans that are impossible to abide by. I present to you that the case plan in this situation was impossible for both parents to complete. Besides being referred to a therapist, there were no other modifications to a case plan for cognitive deficient parents than what a normal parent would have.
Is there such a thing as a case plan for a cognitively deficient parent?
I would suggest that there are additional steps.
I'm not saying that we may not all agree that there should be. My question is whether or not they exist.
I will admit that I'm not an expert in if it's defined as different for cognitively deficient parents. I'm not sure of that.
Thank you.
But the county has admitted that there are additional steps and services for parents that are cognitively deficient, and that parental termination is not necessary for every parent that has cognitive deficiencies. So because the parents in this case were given a case plan that was impossible for them to ever complete, there can be no fault on either one of the parents. Michael has demonstrated that he is a loving father. He is a wonderful provider. He maintained health insurance for his child. He paid child support while the child was in foster care. He went to every meeting and every doctor's appointment that he could make. He's been gainfully employed for over 14 years in the same profession, in the same place. He has made every effort that's been asked of him to try and reunite with his child, and yet the county has said, not good enough. I'd also like to point out that the county has said their adjustments for this family have been that they allowed the family additional time to work on the case plan, and that was their modification for parents with cognitive deficiencies in this case. But then they were able to use that extra time against the parents, arguing that the child had been out of the home for 14 out of the past 20 months, and therefore it's presumed to be in the best interest of the child to terminate parental rights. So in the end, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that the more time we give these parents to work on a case plan that we will not change, that they're not meeting the objectives, then we're going to turn around and say, well, now the child's been out of the home, and now it's in the best interest of the child to be removed. And the proceedings to terminate parental rights must be fundamentally fair, and there is nothing that was fair about either the case plan and the situation to start with or how the proceeding was handled in the district court. And
what do you say to the district? I shared, first of all, my colleague's concern, Justice Sotomayor's concern with this case. It's very difficult and challenging The district court wrote a long order, and on page 14, right before the conclusion, refers to NRS 128-1093, which states that any failure by the agency does not affect the presumptions in place against the parents, and then secondly goes on further as stated above, no evidence was provided upon which the court could conclude that additional services could bring about reunification within a reasonable period of time. Those two statements are very troubling to me in terms of the case that you and Mr. Wall are presenting here, and I'd like to hear your comments on them.
Sure. I don't believe that the county presented evidence that additional services would not have helped the family here. They were questioned about several different available services in the county, and their response was, well, that wouldn't have worked. But no one ever said, I called, I did research, and these people didn't qualify. It was just, well, I know about them, but we never referred them, we never called them, we never looked into them. So to say that additional services would not have helped this family is unfair, because no one ever made any effort to look into those, to see if it was possible, and to explore other options. So the county has repeated over and over in their brief that 128-109 subsection 3 doesn't matter. Over and over, the fact that they didn't provide services does not matter. But that is not in line with a fundamentally fair proceeding, which is what these clients, our clients, are entitled to. So to say that I didn't, we didn't research.
So you're really arguing the statute is infirm.
It creates a problem in my mind that we're allowing the county to not do anything and then say it doesn't matter. And that's what happened here. And it's happened that way from the beginning of this case over and over again.
But, of course, there are the six-month reviews wherein those other services can be tested. Does the record show us that, and there was an illness with one of the workers, if I read the record correctly, that caused some significant delay. Did anyone ever raise to the district court judge, look, these services are available, why isn't the county or the state providing these services? Why aren't they looking into them? Was that before the district judge?
I know that the additional services were brought on during the trial. There was questions of there are at least three other options available. And why our clients...
But that's the TPR trial. By then, it's sort of like the horses out of the...
There were questions to my client, Michael, of why did you not tell them you needed additional services? And I don't think it's fair to put it back on a cognitively deficient parent to say, I need extra help.
Thank you. While you're coming up to the plate, so to speak, I'm going to start with a couple of questions. It appears as if this case followed a procedure that is not widely followed throughout the state, and that is the warrant process initially for removal, which is subject to debate about whether or not that's a requirement in our law. But nonetheless, it appears to me as if that would have established in the record that there was a need to intervene when the state did. Can you talk to me about why that wasn't, other than the prior children that had been removed from this home, why once the failure to thrive was diagnosed, why services weren't provided in-home as opposed to the removal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is, may it please the court, my name is Allison Tess. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washoe County, and I'm representing the state today. To answer your question, Justice Seda, with regard to the warrant, from there, there weren't the available services that would be 24/7 in-home services necessary to keep EW safe. It would require ongoing feedings every 2 hours to be monitored by a public health nurse. And so, unfortunately, we just don't have those community resources for the level of oversight that was necessary. Michael did work outside of the home, and so this infant would be left with Jennifer as his primary caregiver. And so at that time, there was no option but to remove the shed.
And so fast forward through the process of the case plan, you're telling me that there was never a time in the 18 to 24 months that this proceeded, apparently concurrently on the termination track, that there was never a time where they felt that Jennifer was adequately trained to provide the appropriate feedings, even as the child grew older, when when the child would no longer need every couple of hours feeding.
What the testimony shows, Your Honor, is that she was able to show snippets of what she was learning through her hands-on parenting behavior, hands-on training with the human services support specialists, commonly referred to as HIS workers, and then she would revert back to her old behaviors, and so they were seeing the safety issues in these visits over and over again. I did have the senior HIS worker testify to monitoring visits at least between 150 and 200 times where she was still identifying significant safety issues during the time of feeding, stemming from the infant stages all the way to the adolescent stages where feeding was still an issue.
So notwithstanding my factual inquiries that are probably not really an issue for this court to consider, the bigger issue, there's a suggestion that the entire process was fundamentally unfair to both of these parents. And so the question that I am concerned about is whether or not cognitively impaired parents are ever going to be able to retain rights to their children if, in fact, the statutes stay the way they are and the law continues to read the way it is. And now we have a child, unfortunately, who for his entire 4 years does not really know his parents. Isn't there a problem with that? Isn't there a true fundamental fairness question there?
I understand if those are the facts as they exist, but in this case, those are not the facts. The facts are that the department was able to determine that Michael would be or could conceivably be safe and determined that he was learning through the services that were provided to him. And when he was approached with the question if he was willing to separate from Jennifer in order to keep this child safe, he chose to maintain that relationship. So was there a way? My department was trying each and every way to make it possible to return this child home and not go down the road that we went down, and I had several workers testifying to that. The issue was, how do we make it safe to return him home? When posed with the question, are you willing to not divorce your wife, separate, live in a different situation, go reside with your sister, have her exit the home to see if we can send this child home and provide the in-home services without her being present, and he declined to do so. So in this case, Your Honor, it wasn't just his cognitive deficiencies. It was his choice to maintain a relationship which was an unsafe environment for this child, and we could not return him to that environment. As far as Jennifer is concerned, unfortunately, we didn't see a spot or foreseeable time period in which we'd be able to return this child to her. And I do think the law accounts for that. NRS 128, Section 106, talks about mental deficiencies which render a parent unavailable to a child for consistent periods of time. And I'm paraphrasing that statute, but our legislature does speak to this issue. This is an extremely difficult case, a difficult case for everybody involved, because this isn't the outcome that we ever want to see. It was a difficult case because of the cognitive deficiencies. And to answer your question about case plan compliance, we do have a case right on point. The law is clear. It's not enough to comply with the case plan if the lessons the case plan seeks to address are not learned. And I think that, you know, analogous to just a hypothetical scenario in life, if you go to take your driver's test and you pass that, and then you go to take the physical part of your driver's test and you run through a red light and hit a pedestrian, are you going to pass your test? No. And I'm not saying that these parents should be tested, but we're talking about safety. It's not safe to put this child in an unsafe.
Could you address Mr. Wall's point that the removal was premised not just on what was found with this child, but on the prior three children, two of whom were not the mother's biological kids, but she had some role in their supervision. And the fact that, as I understand it, objections were made to the admission of that evidence for the truth of the matter asserted, rather it was looked at as contextual. But in the order, there's a lot of attention paid to that history as justifying the measures that were taken and explaining everything that occurred in this case. I'd like to hear your answer to those points.
Yes, Justice Pickering. So first of all, with regard to the removal, he did say there was not, Mr. Wall said there wasn't evidence of that. I disagree with that. This child, based on Nurse Julie Pomey's testimony, she said would have diagnosed him as failure to thrive at her second visit, but did want to account for the differences in her scales.
But the district court finds that the removal occurred because then 3-week-old Edward had been or might be diagnosed as failure to thrive.
Correct, because there was conflicting testimony. But I believe that the record does support that the public health nurse says what her diagnosis was. I also had an expert witness, Dr. Catherine Wagner, testify to the neurological problems associated with failure to thrive.
But this child didn't exhibit those because the child was removed before those took hold, correct?
Not necessarily yet. They don't know what all the potential consequences of being starved are. It goes from ages 0 to 2, or I'm sorry, infancy to 2, and then from there on, depending on at what age the child is when the starvation occurs. And I do want to try and answer your question about the history. The court didn't just rely on hearsay statements that came in. When any of my workers are assessing a case, history, unfortunately, sometimes is the most telling as far as what steps do we need to take next, excuse me. And so they are required to look at history to assess the family to see what it is that we are looking at as a global picture. What the court was able to also use as evidence is there was an order finding that there was neglect. There was a court report that came in that talked about the starvation of SH, which was the biological daughter of Jennifer House. I also had expert testimony from Dr. Catherine Wagner on the failure to thrive, and that's of the two other children who were actually not Jennifer's biological children, but the children of her live-in partner, and that she was an integral part in the caretaking and feeding of those children. And so a lot of the evidence that the court relies upon isn't necessarily coming in through hearsay, but through expert testimony, through judicial notice of findings and orders in other cases, and through the orders that I submitted as exhibits.
So you're saying the hearsay became a basis for the expert opinion you put in through Wagner?
Some of it did, Your Honor. She did base some of it on hearsay. The hearsay that I think Justice Gibbons was questioning was directly correlated to questions or the objection as to one of my social workers, Casey Schwinn, speaking as to the history that she reviewed prior to assessing the family. And even then, interestingly enough, she still said, I'm going to send Edward home. We are going to give them a chance. We're going to put a public health nurse in there. I'm going to be in there. We're going to do what we can to see if we can teach her and keep this infant in the home, which is always our first option. I think there were absolutely the facts to seek a warrant prior to this child returning from the hospital home with his parents, just based on history alone, because of the extreme vulnerability of the infant. I take great issue with the statement that there was nothing wrong when we ripped this infant away from this mom, because that's not the case, and that's where we end up, and I don't mean to be exaggerating here, but we end up with infant fatalities. We have to move when it's time to move. Otherwise, we end up with the most severe situations, which nobody would ever want to see and ever fault anyone for, but that's what we see if we don't move.
So how much of the warrant was based on prior child care or lack thereof versus what was observed at the time the child was in the home?
What was observed was mostly used for the warrant as far as the judge saying, okay, you've been in there, she's been taught how to feed, she's saying she's feeding how she's being taught, and yet we're still dropping off. The growth chart was at 25%, then 10%, and then completely off the growth chart by the fifth visit, and as I stated, we just don't, unfortunately, have the community resources to provide to the family to mitigate the safety risks in that home. And I believe I'm out of time. But
you have five more minutes, actually.
Oh, I do. Great. Justice Pickering, I did want to touch on your question regarding the court statement on page 14 of her order, Judge Schumacher's order stating, no evidence was provided upon which the court could rest the conclusion that additional services could bring about reunification within a reasonable period of time. And that's, she had stated that pursuant to NRS 127-107, that's the statute where she is looking at what the reasonable efforts are. So when a child isn't placed in at home with their parents and we're looking at a termination, she is looking at what are the reasonable efforts that this department has provided at reunification services toward reunification for this family. And that's when and where she's able to do so. The counsel for the parents didn't put on evidence of any additional services that my clients could have provided in order to enable a lasting parental adjustment or a likely parental adjustment that we could predict within a foreseeable time frame. And that's where best interest, that's where the ASPA, Adoption and Safe Families Act come in, to where we're not allowing a child to linger indefinitely in the foster care system. You are looking at best interest. And when you asked about the presumptions, evidence of the state's failure to provide services not affecting those presumptions, if you step back and look at just from a logical sense, you're looking at best interest of a child only. You're not looking at what's the best interest of the parent at that time and what we did or didn't do for the parent. You're looking what's the best interest of the child, and that's why those presumptions aren't overcome by evidence of the state's failure to provide those services. Where those failures can come in is through the testimony of what additional services my clients could have provided in order to make that lasting parental adjustment. Appleseeds was brought up. You'll see testimony as to why Appleseeds doesn't work. Appleseeds doesn't work because that occurs when the child is placed back home. Those services are back in home. There was mention of SRC, Sierra Regional Center. I may have that acronym incorrect. Those services are qualified-based services. And so when my department implemented the psychologist, Dr. Rogina, to perform the parental capacity evaluations, those do show IQs. They do show that there's lower functioning, but they can also dictate to my workers what other community resources would be available. And I had social worker after social worker after supervisor testifying that in all their years of experience, there wasn't anything else that they could offer or that was available to these parents in order to get them into that place to safely parent together. They thought they could possibly do it with Michael and Jennifer separating, but again, that's a choice that, and nobody minimizes the circumstances of asking him to do so, but that's where we were at the end of 24 months. And the extra time, absolutely. If we're looking at, we have a worker who did have an accident, who never lost oversight of this case, we're looking at the parents started off with different counsel who didn't assist in case plan engagement. Everything that we look at as a totality when we're, I'm asking the court, I'm saying, please find compelling reasons for us not to go on a termination track with this family. One of those compelling reasons in this case at 24 months could have been, I just had Michael agree to trying to live without Jennifer parenting in the home, and we're going to see what we could do. That would have been a compelling reason, but we ran out of those reasons. And unfortunately, this is where we're at. It's a difficult case, not because of the state of the law. I think the law is clear. Factually, I think the record is very clear. There is substantial evidence that supports by clear and convincing evidence the Honorable Judge Schumacher's order. She's very clear on presumptions she didn't apply because they would be unfair. She was very clear on them overcoming a couple of the presumptions, which they did, and nobody took issue with them doing so. Nobody's stating that they didn't complete all the tasks. What was our case plan and service agreement tailored to meet the needs of cognitive cognitive deficiencies? I'd say absolutely yes. And the providers that operated under that case plan were in constant communication with my social workers to ensure that they were providing the additional hands-on services needed for these parents.
Thank you, Ms. Testa.
Thank you.
Mr. Wall, Ms. Ludwig, I would allow 1 minute for rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are a lot of things in this case that I find fundamentally offend my sense of fairness and dignity, but none as much as the suggestion that was made by the county that Michael could stay in his home if he would divorce his wife and kick her out. He could then have a relationship with his son. I can't believe that they have made that offer and that they're
I think I understood the offer to be he moved out, took the child with him, but there was
The offer was he moves out and takes the child or he kicks her out of the home. Either way, she's got to be gone. The issue of the county didn't provide enough services, we can't force the county to provide services it didn't provide. That doesn't answer the question. That the statute says this doesn't affect the presumptions. The first presumption doesn't apply as a matter of law. The second presumption is not supported by any kind of evidence. This court can construe what it means to substantially comply. We don't take away a person's rights when they are doing everything they possibly can. We continue to work with them.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. To each and every one of the advocates here today, thank you for your work and your presentation. The case will stand submitted.